Hello, everyone. I'm Viviana Young, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Molalla, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment, which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. So today with us, we have Alan Lacey, the founder of TLP Media. He's a wildlife videographer.
Yes, so my name is Alan Lacey, and as Viviana said, I'm the director of TLP Media, founder, etc. And TLP Media actually kind of stands for one of my first films that I started, and it was called The Last Pack. It's on Mexican gray wolves. And so it's kind of where I kind of started my roots in filmmaking. That's kind of what I decided to kind of just pay respects to that. So TLP is what that stands for, TLP Media. And that film, actually, we changed the name to Gray Area Wolves of the Southwest. And that was my first project that I ever kind of like launched into. So that's, you know, basically where everything kind of comes to a head right there. So that's why I do what I do.
Did you have any interest in wildlife videography growing up or in your earlier years?
Yeah, actually. So like growing up, I was always fascinated with wildlife and the Central California area out in the country. And I kind of grew up watching all the shows on PBS Nature, National Geographic, and just was enthralled with watching those programs. And I think it instilled a love for wildlife inside me. And so I would spend countless hours out in the countryside, you know, doing my best impressions of biologists researching like California ground squirrels. I remember I'd go out on this little levee kind of in what we called the island district and kind of outside of Visalia and Hanford, Lemoore, that area of Central California. And I would go out to this levee and there was this colony of ground squirrels, California ground squirrels that occupied the levee. And I used to go there and just watch and had these little pens of paper and I would just take notes. I don't have no clue what I actually took notes on, to be honest, but it that's just where as a kid, passionate, love wildlife. And never really thought I would be doing wildlife filmmaking, but I knew I wanted to work with animals. And kind of as I grew up, that love never died. I always kind of had that direction. Went in school, I studied architecture, but then I switched to conservation biology and realized that I couldn't really cut it with like chemistry classes, and some of the biology courses were a little more challenging. And so I ended up not really getting into the biology like I wanted. And so I was just sort of sitting there trying to figure out what am I going to do with life? Ended up just getting a business degree, working in aviation, et cetera. And then one day I woke up, I'm like, you know what? I want to change this. So I reached out to this random organization up in Washington. It was called the Grizzly Bear Outreach Project because they had a posting for a position, which I knew I wasn't going to get. But their director was a gentleman named Chris Morgan, and he looked like someone who could probably help direct me in the right way. So I emailed him. He responded back, and little did I know, but he was a host and narrator for PBS Nature, National Geographic, etc. And he was like, you know, Alan, you ever thought about making a film? Because you don't have to be an expert person in front of the camera. You don't have to be an expert camera operator either, but you can produce and you can get those experts in front of the camera or behind the camera. And I wanted to do something to help Mexican wolves at the time because I had been volunteering at an organization called Southwest Wildlife Educational Center. And they had Mexican wolves there. And there was only like 42 in the wild and they had like 18 in captivity at the time. And so my mind was just like, man, I got to do something to help. So that launched me into the filmmaking. And with Chris's advice, I kind of just went for it, had no clue what I was doing and just started asking around, asking questions, started networking, trying to figure out who are the right people to talk to. And then how do I even get someone to film? So asked around, had a gentleman from ASU who has recently graduated that helped me film my first little part of that film. And then I ended up getting connected with another gentleman who ended up being the director for the film. And he did a lot of work for National Geographic. So that kind of like started me into it and fell in love with wildlife filmmaking at that point. And that's something that I've been kind of pursuing ever since. I've always had to have a job kind of to help me get by, because income through wildlife filmmaking is not always the most luxurious. You go job to job and it's kind of very much like gig work. So I've always had to have a secondary job to kind of help me go through that. But, you know, now I'm able to enjoy life and be able to pursue that fully. So that's been a wonderful journey.
So you said that you had a desire to protect Mexican wolves. Do you know how their populations are doing in more recent times?
Yeah, actually. So when we first started that project, I think the population of the wolves was, I think it was in the 83, I think was about the number when we were filming. It had started at 42 when I first started it, but it took me 7 years to make the film. But by the end of the production, it had 83 in the wild. And we were filming in January, early February into January, when they're doing the population surveys. And they broke through 100 for the first time in the entire history of that program. And now their numbers are, I think they're like 160s or something like that, or even pushing close to 180. We're waiting for the numbers to come out for this year's population counts that they are actually doing right now. So fingers crossed that it'll, you know, be even higher. So we're starting to see some traction to actually having that population grow and expand. Some other challenges with it too, but for, you know, numbers are growing, so that's good.
It's cool to hear that you kept up with their population. Like you followed it. So could you tell us a little bit about, in general, how wildlife videography does help in these conservation efforts?
Yeah, so wildlife videography, you know, for me, if you think about my story, for example, you know, I started out watching PBS Nature, National Geographic as a kid, just fell in love with wildlife and animals. And there's a lot of power in what filmmaking can do. As I produce films and I do, you know, different types of, you know, different levels, whether it's like a documentary or if it's just fun little things I put out on YouTube or something, I'm always conscientious of who my audience is, because you never know if those people that watch it, this might be their first time, their first introduction into wildlife or nature. And kind of my own personal mission is I want people to fall in love with wildlife and nature the way that I did growing up. And so everything I do is kind of pointed at recreating those experiences so that people can also fall in love with nature and wildlife. So wildlife videography to me is extremely important and valuable in bringing stories of conservation, stories of, you know, things you can celebrate in nature, but most importantly, it's a tool that we can use to bring more education to people around the world on various different species or different issues that are going on currently that are important and that we want them to understand. And so film to me is just an extremely powerful way to do that, because it's very impressionistic. You can show the visuals, you can tell the stories. I mean, there's obviously films that probably take that a little too far, go a little too extreme, get over the top, and they exaggerate maybe a little too much. But for me, it's all about being accurate, being science-based, and let the facts tell the story. But then if you can create the visuals around it to support that, and that can then tug at the emotions and the heartstrings of those people that watch it, you know, the story will tell itself. And to me, that's why film to me is so powerful.
I grew up watching films like Planet Earth and other various wildlife documentaries. It really does shape a young person's view of the world. But I think it contributes to scientific knowledge and research. It's a great method of data collection. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's one of the best ways, I think, that you can show the data that's being collected, and you can show the results, and you can show all the different things that people are working on from a scientific perspective, because, you know, it's hard to interpolate when you read a scientific journal or an article what that information is telling you, especially if you don't have the, like if you haven't gone through school and learned how to read those kinds of documents. So film is another great resource and tool that you can use to extrapolate all that information and data and put that out for the viewers to see in a way that really makes sense.
What type of equipment do you use in your work?
That's a good question. So filmmaking for what I do is, depending on the project, kind of depends on the type of equipment. So for some of the larger scale productions that I've worked on, we use some a little more fancy cameras with a little more fancy gear. So I'm currently working on a project on burrowing owls in Eastern Oregon. And for that project, I'm using what they call a red helium camera. It's capable of 8K and it's crazy expensive stuff that I don't own, but it has a really high quality image and it can actually capture a great, what they call dynamic range of color. And so when you use these cameras that are, they end up being more pricey, but with that dynamic range, you can pull out the visuals and the colors and the most beautiful images that you typically see with like something like Planet Earth or something like that. They use those kinds of cameras as well. And just creates that just beautifully colored image. And then for the lens, that's the big kicker. So the camera obviously is what's recording the actual footage, but the lens is what allows you to get up close to wildlife. And so for that project, I'm using a lens that's also insane. It's kind of like the holy grail of wildlife lenses, but it's the Canon 50-1000. So you can zoom in up to 1,000 millimeters. And it even has a built-in teleconverter, which it magnifies it by 1.5 times. So you can literally get out to 1500 millimeters, which is insane. And so you can sit about 50 feet away from burrowing owls and just zoom into their head, which is just phenomenal. The range that you can do is just impressive. But so you use those. And I also use, you know, smaller mirrorless cameras like a Sony a7S III, which is great because it's small, it's versatile. You can kind of go anywhere with it. But it also is great in low light because a lot of wildlife operates, obviously, in the morning and in the evenings when there's not a lot of light out. And a lot of cameras do well during the day and when things are well lit. But when you start dimming down light and the sun fade, you know, the light in the day fades when the sun's down or before it comes up, it's often hard to get a clean, crisp image because most camera sensors aren't capable of that low light setting. The Sony a7S III is much better. It can do a lot better. Still, you know, there's still limits with it, but it allows us to get out earlier and stay out later, which is awesome. And then just, you know, it all comes down to lenses. There's so many different variations of wide angle lenses to telephoto zooms. I own personally just the Sony a7S III and a Sigma 60-600, and then a couple like Sigma 24-70, which carries a range of more like, if I'm working in the field with a biology, something like that, it's much easier to work with that kind of a lens than a bigger, longer telephoto lens, because you're going to be like right up in the work that they're doing. So having options to zoom out, see the whole scene, or punch in just a little bit and get detail work is a good thing to have. But those are like the main things with cameras. Then you also have like audio equipment you have to use. So you have different recorders for various types of audio you're wanting to get, or sometimes you can get just like wireless mics for if you're working with biologists, you want to have them working in the field. You can have shotgun microphones. There's just so much stuff that you have to carry around. And when you go on trips, it can often look kind of daunting. I have just cases and cases of Pelican cases, and it's just, you know, there's 15 to 20 different bags with all that gear and everything. It looks daunting, but when you get out into the field, it all kind of works together because it is useful tools and equipment for where you're at.
As you said, there is a lot of stuff that you need to basically lug around. And I'm sure that that's even further complicated by possibly dangerous or difficult terrain. Do you often have to go into dangerous terrain, or maybe do you have encounters with animals that might put your safety at risk? And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so typically, you know, depending on where you're going to shoot, and you know, and I haven't really had any dangerous situations in my experience yet. But when you're going on to different locations. So you're going to pack the gear that you know you're going to need for those locations. So like if for instance, I was filming in the Eastern Wallowa Mountains on a Wolverine project, when we were using horses to get back into the backcountry. And so I know you can't carry like 15 cases of gear back there unless you have a huge pack train of mules to take it all. And even that's kind of obsessive or excessive rather. It would be obsessive if I decided to take it. But so you just know like, okay, this is the location we're going to be filming at. So what's the gear that's going to get the job done? So something like that. I don't want to carry a whole bunch of huge, heavy gear. So I'm going to do lighter, more versatile run gun style equipment. So like that Sony A7S3 is perfect. Smaller cameras like a Canon C300 or something would work great. But, you know, carrying that big, huge, you know, red helium with a 50 to 1000 lens, which is, you know, it's all set up. It's about 5 feet, 4 feet long, maybe. It's pretty big and really heavy, 50, 60 pounds. So that's kind of overkill for getting into that kind of terrain. As far as wildlife and situations like that, so you obviously want to get the footage that you set out to film. And let's say, you know, for that, I'm wanting to film wolverines, but in that area, there's only one, so that you're not really going to see it. So I wasn't expecting to film him. I was actually setting up trail cameras. But most wildlife, as long as you respect their boundaries and understand their behavior and give them the distances that they require, you'll do all right. You're not going to typically be in a situation that would be dangerous. Now, obviously, certain species of wildlife can be more dangerous, so it's important to know and work with a local guide. If you're in areas that maybe you don't know the behavior so well, so having a guide that helps you out is kind of essential because they understand the behavior of the animal. They know what's going on and understand if things are cool at the moment or if something changes, you know, the need to get out of there. They have that experience. So that's always the important thing to do. Doing it on your own, unless you know the behavior, that's the recommendation that is probably the best to go by.
So in addition to guides, I suspect that you might have to fill out or seek permits to film in some of these locations. How do you decide on the locations and do you have to get permits?
Yes. So definitely need to get permits depending on the location. Some places don't require permitting, but permitting is essential because it gives you the access on the location. So if, you know, for our burrowing owl story, for example, we're filming on an old decommissioned chemical weapons depot. And so if we just showed up on a military base with cameras and started filming, that wouldn't go so well. So we have to work ahead of time before we get there, contact the right authorities, the people that have the ability to grant the access, get a document signed with the permits and the permission to be out there. And then we carry that permission with us. In case someone asks us, hey, what are you doing? We can show them, hey, we've got the permission. Here's the permits. So you do that pretty much anywhere you go. And it also works out because if you're going to have a show that ends up on television, whoever's going to purchase the rights to that show, or if they've commissioned it, they want to make sure that they have the rights to be able to show the footage that you've recorded at whatever location you're at. So having that permit is kind of essential and crucial. Sometimes they're free. Sometimes they cost a lot of money. It all just varies and depends upon the places that you are looking to film. And then oftentimes, if it's like international, different national parks in different countries, some of those funds go to help conservation. Some of them helps, you know, the local people out. So, you know, it's all kind of a win-win.
And how do you generally decide on the locations you'd like to film?
So on deciding on that, so if we're filming, you know, like, for example, I was working with a friend of ours and we were filming in the Kalahari Desert in Botswana. Those locations were based upon the story that we want to tell. I'm under NDA, so I can't really explain too much of the story, and I won't, but the species that we wanted to focus on for that story are located in the northern section of the Kalahari Desert. So that's kind of where we obviously look at and we figure out, okay, these are where these species are. And what areas can we have the best chances of filming the species and looking for the particular types of behavior? And then you can settle on, okay, this national park has a lot of sightings of this type of species and this type of behavior seems to be a common thing that happens there. So then you can focus on that national park and you can contact the people there to get your permits going. And once you've got that established, then you're good to go. So you kind of pick your location based on the type of species or the behavior, or if there's a certain visual you're looking for, that's kind of what dictates the locations or where your biologists or the people are at. So it's basically where your story is taking place. That's kind of what you look for the location that you want to film. And then you have to figure out all the different, sometimes it's not just one place you got to permit. Sometimes it's like 6, 7, 10 different properties all intermixed and you got to connect with all the different landowners. And yeah, it can get kind of convoluted, but important to do nonetheless.
Do you have any experience filming anything here in Oregon?
I do, actually. So I used to live in Oregon in the Portland area, currently in Phoenix. But yeah, I filmed our Broming Elk project. It's still ongoing, but we've been filming up there in Umatilla and been doing that for the last three years now. This is our fourth year. I don't think we'll probably film a little bit there this spring, but not much. We're pretty much wrapped up with that. But I've also filmed in the Wallawas out by Enterprise with our Wolverine story that I'm also producing that's kind of getting closer to being finished as well. And then I've done a lot of small little projects just on the side here and there all throughout Oregon, a lot of wildlife refuges and beautiful, beautiful place to film. Absolutely love it. The species are amazing. I've got a couple of films in development that I'd love to do eventually too, which that always is a challenge because it always comes down to funding really, especially when you do it yourself. But I also want to focus on the Humboldt Martins down on the southern coast as well, because they're an endangered population and a lot of really interesting things on that story that I'd like to focus on too. So that's something I'm real keen on making happen, but right now it's just in development. So we'll see if that ends up getting off the ground or not, but yeah, Oregon's beautiful.
So you've already mentioned a few films that you're working on or that you've made in the past. Do you have any more that you'd like to mention or highlight as some you're particularly proud of or that might be popular?
Yeah, so I, you know, obviously my first film, Gray Area, Wolves of the Southwest. If you guys are interested, you can go to grayareathefilm.com, and that's G-R-A, not G-R-E, so gray with an A, grayareathefilm.com. And that's where my first film on the wolves is. Currently working on a story on burrowing owls. I'm going to call that, I think, Burrowing Owls, a love story. And that's a really cute story about this biologist who has dedicated his life to the mission and rescue of burrowing owls here in Oregon. And, you know, he's founded the Global Owl Project. He studies owls all over the world, has some, over 200 and some odd scientists and researchers working for him. But this film is specifically focused on the burrowing owl. Got my Wolverine film. That's going to be a short film. And that one's probably going to be released online for free for people to see, because I believe in like the public good. So instead of making people always have to pay for films, it's nice to have people be able to watch them too and actually learn and experience things like that. So that should be coming out fairly soon. And then I've got a lot of other films in development that I haven't started yet. The one of the Kalahari that we just filmed at, that's a friend of mine. So that should be coming out at some point soon. He's with the All Around Project, so you can keep your eyes there if you're interested in the footage from Africa. And got a couple things in National Geographic that will be coming out in like next spring, I think, a year out. So I'm not sure if I can actually mention the name of that film or series, but it'll potentially be on Disney Plus or National Geographic, and the footage of burrowing owls, that's what I've been filming with them for that, will be on there as well. So
in your time, have you seen any unusual behavior either on film or off from animals that you've seen?
I mean, my experience out with tons of different species is kind of limited. I mean, I've had my trip in Africa, Aruba, here in the States, but I think one of the most unique things that I've filmed is, you know, I keep coming back to this burrowing owl story. It just fascinates me, these burrowing owls. I worked with the biologist and we created a system to film the burrow underneath the ground in pitch darkness to see what happens in the total dark. We don't really know what goes on inside the burrows. I mean, we can kind of guess, but there's never been any footage in a wild situation of what takes place underneath inside their home. So set it all up, and it was amazing to see just the behavior from underneath the ground. You have the female bringing food and seeing the youngsters running around and making all kinds of ruckus and feeding, and just, it was cool. We all kind of knew that was a place, but actually seeing it was just incredible. And the different species of insects and mice and voles and stuff that they were bringing in and feeding, and how the mom singles out which chicks to feed. It's just really, that was just fascinating. And the biologist was just beside himself, just in awe of watching it, because he had never seen it before. So it was really, that was a really cool moment, actually.
So circling back a little bit to scientific observation, have you ever noticed any growth or decrease in certain animal populations? So when you're watching them, have you had any personal experiences with an animal maybe just not showing up as often anymore, or maybe now you're seeing one every day, whereas you used to have a hard time finding them?
As far as mammals are concerned, you know, my experience in the time that I've been doing wildlife filmmaking, it's been, you know, probably what, 10 years or so. So it's not been a significant chunk of time really to notice too much of that. But when I think back on, you know, growing up as a kid, and especially driving through Central California with the headlights on, just the sheer number of insects that would just plaster itself all over the vehicle compared to now driving through that area, same kind of time of year, hardly any. And, you know, most people probably could care less about insects and stuff, but they're important too. They have purposes and their ecological niches that they serve. And when you have huge crashes of insect populations like that, you see effects that take place in bird species that rely on those insects. And so bird populations start to dwindle. And I remember as a kid watching these huge like murmurations of like red-winged blackbirds and different species of birds, that just the sheer number, and then compared to today, it just doesn't seem like the overall bird population is the same. And then it seems like when you read the research that's going on, there's just declining populations across the board for different species. I mean, even species that are considered stable, such as like the cactus wren here in Arizona, for example, there's tens of thousands of them, it seems like, all over the place. And you can hear them everywhere. They're kind of the call of the Sonoran Desert. But then when you look at the what people are researching, they're saying, you know, every year the population declines by maybe 1% or something like that. And at least since the 60s, it seems like it's been doing that. So even though there's a whole bunch of them out there still, there's still decline. And even though they're not at risk of going extinct or anything, just the trend for a lot of different species seems to be decline, which is sad.
And now for some brief announcements. Do you want to reconnect to your community? Do you want to access our local trails more often? Do you just need some sunshine? Good! This February 26th at 10 a.m., head to the Roseburg Duck Pond by Fred Meyer for a Trails Day event. Help us keep the Thrive Umpqua Blue Zones Project Umpqua Trail clean and welcoming to our community. Enjoy good company and a brisk walk as well. All are welcome to join. Thrive Umpqua and United Communities AmeriCorps also invite you to the St. Patrick's Pedal and Pet event. Bike or walk with us on March 12th at 10 a.m. Bring your gear to the half shell and wear green. This family-friendly event encourages natural movement and a greener, healthier mode of transport. We hope that by sharing this ride together, we can make underutilized routes become more active as the weather warms. It's fun for everyone, with a raffle opportunity after the route is completed. Visit Thrive Umpqua's Facebook event page to sign up and for more information. If you love to read and would like to discuss environmental topics with fellow bookworms, try Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club. Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club meets over Zoom every other month and will next meet on Saturday, March 26th. The book to be discussed will be Waste, One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret by Catherine Coleman Flowers. All sessions take place virtually at 5 p.m. on their date. For more information, please email Umpqua Watershed's Director of Education and Outreach, Ryan Kincaid. Her email is ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Or if you'd like to share your environmental knowledge with the community by being interviewed for an episode of Living Downstream, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. So have you ever had anything that you've seen that was just amazing, but you didn't manage to capture it on film that you'd like to tell us about?
I mean, there's a couple different situations. I think the most intense one that I've had, and it wasn't like dangerous or anything, but this is a couple of years ago now, but it was actually when the burrowing owl project, but I was focused on filming the young little burrowing owls in the entrance of the burrow, and the female was asleep and the male was asleep, and burrowing owls, they post guards, so they will stand outside. The males particularly will sit out on a perch somewhere and just keep guard and watch for any danger and for predators, essentially, like, you know, coyotes are obviously a big problem, foxes probably too, birds of prey are also a big one for them, so, you know, red-tailed hawks, harriers, different larger owls like great grays or gray horned, etc., can all prey on these guys. So, you know, it's very important for them to stay alert and keep an eye out for danger. So it was a late morning. It's kind of hot. Everybody's dozing. The young chicks are kind of like sleeping in the entrance of the hole. And then they kind of like tucked back inside of the shade to get some sleep. Mom's sleeping, as is dad. And I'm focused, like I said, on those little guys. And all of a sudden I hear all this racket off to my left. And I'm like these insane calls from a burrowing owl that I've never heard before. And I look over to the left and I see the female burrowing owl. She's fluttering up in the air, making all kinds of ruckus. And I look a little more to the left. And then I see a female northern harrier hawk. And she is over the top of the male, and I can tell that, you know, that's not a good thing. And she keeps squawking, and eventually the harrier, you know, after it had pinned the male long enough, took off flying. You could see it in its talons, and it was sad because he was a good dad and a good father. But the female kept harassing the harrier, and as they flew higher and higher and higher, she kept just staying just above the harrier and making all kinds of ruckus. Eventually the harrier dropped the male. He was gone, which was sad, but they just went really, really high up in the air. I've never seen a burrowing owl get that high into the sky before. And every time she would get too close to the harrier would flip up on its back and put its talons up, but the burrowing owl, she would not get that close. And eventually she got enough distance and felt safe enough that she just tucked her wings in and dive bombed straight down to the entrance of the burrow in this very quick swoop, looked up once, gave an alarm call, and jumped back inside the burrow and hid. So that was intense. I was kind of shocked to see that happen. And unfortunately, I was too engrossed in watching what happened to actually put the camera over there. But so we didn't get any of that footage, which would have been insane, but certainly a sad moment. But it's one of those things, it's like, as a wildlife filmmaker, you're always torn with, do I interfere? Do I jump out and scare the hawk off? Maybe the young burrowing owl will have a chance to make it. Or do I do what I believe is ethically right and let nature take its course? And it's really hard to just sit and do nothing and watch that. You know, same thing when in Africa, we watched a cheetah take a zebra foal. And that was hard to watch too. But at the same time, you know, the cheetahs get to enjoy a meal. We did film that one though. So that was all right. But it's hard as someone who cares about wildlife to let nature take its course like that. But, you know, that's what nature is. It's not always kind.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention interfering with the wildlife. I heard just recently, strangely enough, about some old films where the filmmakers kind of irresponsibly interfered with the wildlife in a harmful way, and it unfortunately ended up costing the lives of
several Arctic birds. And there have been numerous examples of that sort of thing in all sorts of different wildlife films and videography in general. So, could you just maybe take a second to explain why it is such a bad idea, especially as a filmmaker, to influence animals in this way or to influence nature?
Yeah, so one of the important things, especially as a wildlife filmmaker, you don't want to interfere. It's kind of the ethics of wildlife filmmaking. And really, it should be for everybody, interfering with wildlife. So let's say if I interfered with that harrier hawk and prevented it from killing that adult male burrowing owl, then the harrier hawk goes away hungry. Now, unfortunately, it went away hungry anyways because the females are able to harass it herself. But if you interfere like that, or if we just stop the cheetah from killing the foal, now the cheetahs are going hungry, and that can be a death sentence to cheetahs. I mean, it is for the zebra foal too, but when you interfere with something like that, no matter how good your intentions are, there's always a loser, and the loser is always wildlife. So even when you intend to do something good, wildlife will suffer because of it. And so it's just better to let nature take its course. And even though it's hard to watch, hard to see, it's just best that way. Because, you know, interfering with wildlife, it's important not to do that, because number one, like if you interfered with the zebra foal, if being taken by cheetah, for example, the cheetahs would go away hungry, and that would be potentially a death sentence for those cheetah. But then also for the foal, like, not only do they have a cheetah interfering with it, now all of a sudden a human being comes in and they would just be even more terrified. So, you know, wildlife always loses whenever we try to interfere and you know, make life better for what we think is something that we would believe to be better. But really, let nature take its course. It's just better off for everybody that way.
Yeah, watching a zebra foal get attacked does sound pretty unfortunate and upsetting. On the other hand, I'm sure you've had some exciting and interesting moments during your career. What would you say is the most exciting or interesting footage that you've ever captured?
Let's see. Interesting. Well, some of the most exciting stuff is probably the most boring, but what, using like trail camera footage when you don't really know what you're going to get. And so when we were filming with the wolverine story, there's only one wolverine in all of the Wallawas that we know of in Eastern Oregon. His name is Stormy. And there's, you know, hundreds of square miles of just open wilderness, and trying to film it as a wildlife filmmaker going out with a camera would just be nearly impossible. So setting up trail cameras is kind of the way to do that, non-invasive. And then you just use the natural behavior of a wolverine, and as they're studying it, you can see the footage of it. So that was probably the most exciting, when we didn't know if he was still around, because it had been a few years since they did any studies to see if this Stormy, if he was still there. He was getting older. And so we put the cameras out, and then when we went and checked the camera stations a few months after putting them out after the winter, and when the biologist saw the footage, it was just, that is the craziest, coolest thing to kind of have that validation. You just don't know. It's like kind of like Christmas opening up a present. That's pretty exciting. I've had a few moments with the owls as well too, with, you know, other harrier hawks flying in, and we had a little standoff between a burrowing owl dad and another female harrier. She was sitting on his perch and he was in the burrow, and they were both looking at each other, kind of just sizing each other up. And it was pretty crazy. Had coyotes come in once we filmed with Den at the burrowing owl site. And in Africa, obviously the cheetah foal, that was insane. Pretty exciting moment as well. But really kind of like just being in the presence of these huge, large male African Kalahari lions, those things. I had never been to Africa before until I was on this trip. And just seeing their presence on the landscape was just awe-inspiring. It just really kind of like strikes you to your core, kind of like, it like really invokes that primal instinct inside of you. When they look at you, you're just like, holy smokes, these guys are no joke. It was like, not filming it exciting wise, but just being in their presence was pretty exciting, especially when they come up right up next to the car that you're in. and it's open vehicle. And if they wanted to, they can come in there, but they don't, which was thankfully the right thing they did. But it was pretty cool.
So in the time we've been talking, you've mentioned burrowing owls several times. Is that your favorite animal?
You know, they've grown on me. I would have said probably a while back that I didn't even really care about them. But, you know, now that I've been working on this project for quite a while, they've really grown. And they're just cute. They're amazing little creatures. The fact that they can survive where they do, and the story that we've been filming is just also a really cool story. And they're just adorable, especially when you see them grow up from being these young little fluff balls that just look like some sort of alien comes out of the ground, to when they get a little bit bigger, they start looking more like an actual burrowing owl. They're just so freaking cute. They're up there. But actually, my favorite animal, believe it or not, is a raccoon. For some reason, those things just tug my heartstrings like you wouldn't believe. They're just freaking cute, super adorable, and they're smart. They're mischievous. They're intelligent. People call them problem animals, and I just call it, you know, they're just smart, and they know what to do to keep making your life miserable. And they're just doing their natural thing. So people should learn how to be more raccoon savvy and think like a raccoon and say, hey, well, they have fingers too. They can pick things. They can get into things, you know? So, and the raccoons, honestly, that's a film I'd love to do. I have never started developing one, but a story on raccoons would be amazing. They're just such a fun, just charismatic little guy that I think people just would fall in love with.
They almost have like thumbs. They don't actually have thumbs, but they almost do. If you look at their paws, they got little hands.
Yeah, I mean, they do have 5 digits. Mm-hmm. They especially when you look at their tracks, they can actually kind of look like a human handprint if you put it in the ground. They have a ton of sensory things in their hands where they can feel their environment with their fingers. So that's why you see them constantly using their hands and touching the ground, the food. People think that they wash their food, but it could be that, but it's just more of probably the feeling of the water and the food. It enhances the feeling that their food of what they're going to eat. And they know, I guess, what they're looking for, particularly when they actually find whatever food that they can then eat it. But yeah, they're amazing little creatures.
There used to be a video going around the internet for a while of a raccoon trying to wash cotton candy. Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And it dissolved, and it was the most tragic looking raccoon I've ever seen.
Yeah. That's true. It was funny though.
Mm-hmm. All right. So how can people who are interested in wildlife videography work get started? What would you say is required?
So honestly, if anyone's interested in becoming a wildlife filmmaker or working in the field of wildlife filmmaking, natural history, etc., the main thing that you would need to get started in this field is honestly a passion to work in the field. You don't need to have a degree in filmmaking or a degree in biology. I mean, those things are certainly helpful, but like in my case, I have neither. And I just worked hard, figured out a way to make it work for myself. And now I'm doing this, you know, as a living, and it's a lot of fun, but passion is really what drove me. So you do not have to be an expert. Like what I was told is you don't have to be an expert cameraman, and you don't have to be an expert biologist. You just have to be, if you know how to work with people, how to put those experts in front of the camera or behind the camera and just produce, you can just do. And I just tell people, the more you think about it, the more you talk about it, the more you plan about it, nothing ever happens. You just got to get out and do. So if you want to be a wildlife filmmaker, grab your iPhone, go out, start filming, look for insects, look for different things. If you have a hummingbird feeder in your backyard, put a little tripod up with your iPhone and set it there and then walk away and let the hummingbirds come in. You'll get some pretty cool footage, I guarantee you. And just start practicing, work on telling stories, watch other documentaries, and especially ones that you really enjoy or different types of films that you enjoy in the documentary world. Study them, see what they're doing. Find people that are doing that also, and then ask them, hey, if you ever need someone to carry your gear around or if you need help with, et cetera, I'd love to come out and join you. Not everyone will probably have the ability to do that, but some will. So, and be persistent. Persistence is key. If you ask 10 people and they all say, no, we don't have the ability to have you come out, and you quit, who knows, that 11th person you would ask might be the one that said, oh, sure, come out. We'd love to have it. And if volunteer, you don't always have to get paid. Volunteer, get the experience. And then the more you just get out there and work with people or work on your own, eventually people see, and eventually you get the skills, you get the experience, you network with the right people, and there you go. Now you're in the world of wildlife filmmaking.
Do you have any tips or tricks or techniques that you use that you would recommend that get the best sort of footage?
Yeah. So like if you're using like an iPhone or like a GoPro or something like that, you would obviously film in landscape mode, unless you're like doing Instagram stories, of course, but landscape mode is the best way to frame. But I would look into what they call the rule of thirds for your composition. So think of your screen as intersected in thirds. So you have the left third, the middle third, the right third, the top third, the middle third, and the bottom third. And you want your subjects of whatever you're filming, if you're really focusing on something intently, you want to put it in the middle, but maybe not right smack in the middle. Put it a little bit left of center, a little bit right of center. If you're filming something with a lot of sky and you want to see a lot of clouds, then put the horizon down in that lower third section, maybe even a little bit lower than the lower third, maybe halfway, maybe a third of the lower third. So you get a lot of sky. And if you're filming something with really cool foreground and awesome landscapes, then you can also do the opposite and put the horizon at the top third. Just, working with those thirds is really what helps, your composition. Another thing, a cool thing, especially with landscape, if you're filming something with an animal walking through a landscape, use landscape to help frame your subject. And still using that rule of thirds, there's a tree on the right and your subject's in the middle-ish. And let's say there's another little shrub on the left. You can put those two things, those two plants, on the right third and the left third, and your subject's in the middle. Just things like that can really improve your videography a lot in terms of actual composition. But it really, the best advice is just to get out and do it. You'll learn and you'll see what looks good the more you do it. And you don't need big fancy equipment. You just, literally your iPhone or a GoPro, something like that is perfect to get started, because you can start seeing what it's like to actually start filming. And with like a GoPro, you can literally look at the animals, study the behavior, see what they do. If, let's say you want to film birds in your backyard, see which birds come in to the yard. Where do they tend to sit? Where do they tend to go? If there's a certain perch that they tend to go to a fair amount, go put your GoPro out there, set it up, have it sitting in an area where you can get a good image of that bird when it comes in, and then just hit record and walk away and see what happens. You might get some pretty cool footage. There's been so many times where I've just put GoPros out, not expecting anything interesting, and then you come back and you look at it and you're like, oh my goodness, two birds came and had a little tussle right there. I mean, nothing crazy, but cool. It's a little insightful thing into nature when you can do stuff like that. So yeah, I'd say go do those things, have fun with it.
So earlier you mentioned that some of your equipment and some of the permits and that sort of thing can get really expensive. And what you do is very important. Is there anywhere where people can donate or help in any way?
Yeah, there is. And that is one of the things that's always challenging, especially for me, because I tend to self-produce most of my work. And that is, obviously raising funds. And so you can go to my website, which is tlpmediafilms.com. And you can see my work there. And if you go to the support page, and there's a donate as well, there's a couple options. My organization is currently a nonprofit in Oregon, but it's not a federally nonprofit organization yet. So I do have a fiscal sponsor, which is the Oregon Wildlife Foundation. and they can receive tax deductible donations on my behalf for, and then they oversee that. So there is an option for those of you who, if you are interested in supporting this work, that you can give a tax deductible donation to. And there's a link to that on my website as well. So tlpmediafilms.com. And that you can see the different projects there. So yeah, if you look for the specific for the Oregon Wildlife Foundation, the link will take you to their page where you can support my work through them.
Is there any way that people with questions or who are looking for more information could contact you directly through either your website or an email or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, on my website, they can always fill out the form there too. That's simple and easy. And that comes to me. Or they can also, if they want to connect with me, like on social media, on Instagram, I think my handle is Alan, A-L-A-N-P, Patrick, which is what P stands for, underscore L-A-C-Y. So Alan P underscore Lacey. You can connect on Instagram that way. I'm always happy to talk to people. But probably email would be the best way. So they can just go to the contact form on my website and send an email that way. And I'd be happy to answer questions. I also engage fairly well with the community on YouTube. I have a small, fun little YouTube channel where I do behind the scenes work of my work that I actually do, different projects. And that's called Filming the Wild. It's on YouTube. So if you just look up Filming the Wild on YouTube, you'll see my work there. I've got like 20 some videos out there that are just fun, short little things that kind of take people behind the scenes of wildlife filmmaking. It's also a great educational resource for those of you who may be interested in learning to be a wildlife filmmaker. But yeah, you can comment on there. And I always get back to people and respond. So that's another great way to connect with me too.
Well, it was great hearing from you. Thank you so much for appearing on Living Downstream. Do you have any parting words before we close down?
Well, I would just say for anyone who's interested in wildlife filmmaking or just wildlife in general, I just want to say thanks for those of you who actually care about nature. And we can't always, fix something on our own, but as a collective, we can always do our part to help make this world a better place, not only for us, but for the wildlife, for nature. So I just say thanks for caring and getting on doing that. And again, like I say, we can talk, we can plan, we can just really work up all kinds of different things to do. But if we don't actually get out and do something, that's the main thing. So just get out and do. That's kind of my advice, my parting words. Just go do something.
Well, on behalf of all of those people that you mentioned who do love nature and the environment, thank you as well. Your kind of work is very important in multiple ways, such as you mentioned earlier, showing people, both young and old, how magical and how fantastic nature is, and educating people through your films. And in some ways, aiding in research and data monitoring, such as population growth or animal behavior. Without your kind of work, the fields of biology and environmental studies just wouldn't be where they are today.
You really show us a perspective that people would otherwise never have the opportunity to see.
So, I look forward to watching some of your films and seeing what you come out with in the future. So once again, just thank you so much for what you do and for appearing on Living Downstream to share your knowledge. And I think that will finish it up for us.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Viviana. I appreciate it. And I hope you all enjoyed as well.